Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Today we commence a new Open House series on addictions, behaviours and preoccupations that sometimes defy common sense and our ability to take control of our own lives. We're starting with gadgets and mobile phones. Let's put some context around this conversation for a moment. In 2007, the number of mobile phone services exceeded the number of Australians for the very first time. 21 million mobile phone services in active operation. In that same year, 2007, it was also reported that children were spending, on average, 5 hours a day one-on-one with technology. That's in 07. Imagine what the figures are like right now in 2014. In 2012, the Australian Bureau of Statistics reported that nearly a third of all 5 to 14-year-olds had their own mobile phone connections. So let's turn now to our desperate connection to mobile phones. In fact, it's so widespread, it has its own name. Nomophobes, those who are addicted to their phones. Dr. Shari Walsh is the principal psychologist at Growth Psychology in Queensland. Dr. Walsh, great to meet you. Thank you for your time. To what extent do nomophobes fit the bill as addicts?
It's basically in terms of psychology, an addiction is any behaviour or activity that detracts from your ability to live life, so that it takes over and is given the primary involvement in your life to the cost of, say, your work or your family groups. So with mobile phone addiction, because mobile phones now have access to a lot of social media sites, there's actually a whole combination of things that people would be addicted to, but primarily it's the staying connected to other people and the needing to always know what other people are doing or to let other people know what you're doing. There are studies that show that people who are addicted, in layman's terms, to using their mobile phone do actually have neurochemical changes in their brain, that if people can't use their phone, they get highly anxious and they think quite constantly, you know, what's going on? I need to get in touch with it. I need to be checking it. So they are all signs of an addictive behaviour.
Let's touch on those who are prone to an addiction. Are we looking at an addiction to a mobile phone, for instance, as not dissimilar to a gambling addiction in so much as that I have a proclivity toward it?
It's different in that it's similar in that people have a need that they're filling by a behaviour. So there's something in them that they want to do or that they need to kind of fulfil within themselves, and they're using an external method to do that. It's probably more related, though, to the fact that we all have an innate need to connect to other people. And so for some people whose self-esteem or self-identity is very reliant on feedback from other people, they're often more likely the people who would show signs of becoming addicted or over-connected to their phones. Gambling is a different arena in that people are often stimulated by the excitement and the adrenaline rush that they get. So they may have a tendency towards an addiction, but I think with phones it's much more particularly they have a very strong need to be connected to others.
The paradox, I suspect, in this is that they need to be connected, but in truth they're actually disassociating themselves from their physical relationships by virtue of their attachment to a phone.
Absolutely. Some people are, and I think it's very important to remember that there are many, many people who use their phones quite okay and don't prioritise it. But for those people, I do a lot of couples work, a lot of relationships work in my practice, and there are a lot of couples who come in extremely strong conflict over the fact that one partner will be sitting there using Facebook or on LinkedIn or Instagram or all these different things, and the other partner is feeling quite lonely. And we've all seen instances where people go out to dinner and, you know, there's two people sitting there at a table, both texting away or using their phones.
Yeah.
So it offers a really good advantage in, and I'm not against technology at all, it offers a great advantage in staying connected, in being able to quickly contact those people who are important to us. But when we're with those people, they ultimately should be the priority, because they're there face-to-face and that's ultimately much more rewarding.
Increasingly, our employers are asking us to be contactable all of the time. So part of the drive to check our email in the middle of a restaurant meal may not necessarily be attached to our own addiction to the phone.
No, that's exactly right. And I run my own business, so there could be quite a pull towards having my phone on all the time. But it's important to realise that we all need time off. And in order to function healthily, we need quiet times. We need times when our mind is able to still and to calm. So for many people, that takes the form of meditation or praying or getting involved in some activity where they're able to focus. Now, the more we use technology, the less we're able to do that, because we start to get a hectic brain. It's thinking of too many things at once. So for people who really would like to stay calm and to have some element of peace in their lives, prioritising technology is not healthy. You're right.
Yeah.
With the work thing, sorry, I digressed there. From my perspective, I do a lot of work with employees who are suffering stress at work. It's important to discuss boundaries with your employer. What time am I expected to be on, able to access emails? Can I turn it off at work? And if it's possible, don't get your work email forwarded to your device, or have a timing on it so that it only comes on at particular times.
Conversations around expectations or even addictions are tricky things to start. How do we start that conversation in a way that is useful?
Ultimately, with any conversation when we're bringing up a difficult issue, it's really important to acknowledge that we're about to do that. So the first thing to say, and it's really helpful to never say, I don't want to upset you, because you're going to.
Yeah.
So it's quite generally important to open and say, this is a really difficult topic for me to raise, and I expect that you may get upset, or I'm aware that you might be concerned about what I'm going to say, or you may disagree. So that then allows their brain to be accepting of the information that they're going to hear. And then we talk about the behaviours. I've been noticing that when we're eating dinner, you're actually using the phone, and we try to get rid of the word you as much as we can. I've noticed that your attention is on the phone quite regularly, and that there's an interesting conversation going around and you're not able to contribute to that.
Mm.
Or I'm noticing that when you're at work and your phone rings, you actually stop the task that you're doing and move to the phone. So you do have to insert you sometimes, but we try to minimise it in terms of defensiveness. So you talk specifically about the behaviour. These are the behaviours that I'm noticing, and this is the consequence of that behaviour. You're not as engaged with the family, or we're not feeling connected to you, we miss you, or the work that needs to be done isn't getting done. And then it would be asking that person, I'm just wondering if you've noticed that as well. Because often they have, but they just don't know what to do about it. My basic premise is that if we raise an issue, we have a responsibility to offer a solution.
Okay.
So there may be many people who disagree with me with that. So I do believe it's appropriate then to say, look, how about we try next time that we sit down and eat dinner, that everyone has their phone turned off and put away or in another room. Would that be okay with you?
Okay.
So I do think it is helpful, because we can raise a problem or an issue, and if the other person isn't quite ready to accept that, they're not going to know what to do.
Is there research around mobile phone addictions that will show us that this is wasting a lot of our time, or it's making us less productive or less influential in our community?
Yes, there's a whole research body in that area, and I have to admit I haven't been in the research field for a few years now, so my observations in recent years are from my practice, not from the research arena. I do keep in touch with it. But I did research looking at how much people prioritise their phone over work. We looked at mobile phone use while driving and the dangers of that, and the reasons why people use their phone. There's research showing that people who concentrate on their phone are losing parts of their peripheral vision, or that they're not able to pick up peripheral cues as quickly. The communication styles and patterns are changing, and also that people are less able to understand non-verbal communication cues because they're not seeing them as much. So there's a whole growing, quite a large body of research out there about the good and the bad effects of mobiles on people's lives.
And is this a Google search away? Could we just look
Absolutely.
In?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
Right.
So either mobile phone use and whatever it is, or in America they're called cell phones, although they are now starting to use mobile phones. But yes, there's a whole range of different articles that can be read.
Dr. Shari Walsh, working with those addicted to their mobile phones through her practice at Growth Psychology in Queensland. We're joined now by a mum who has dedicated her life to breaking the stranglehold of phones on our kids. Close to Christmas in 2012, Vicky Richardson lost her daughter in a car crash. Brooke was on her way to work when she was sending an SMS and was killed. If you text and drive, you're 25 times more likely to be involved in a car accident. Vicky, I'm a little conflicted right now, I'll be honest, in that I'm grateful you've joined us on Open House, but it's the saddest of reasons. Take us back to December 4, 2012, would you?
Yes, firstly, thank you for having me and listening to my story. The day that it happened, I was at work. I just entered my workplace and I got a phone call from Brooke's boss. Brooke was late for work and Brooke's boss rang me and just wanted to know if Brooke was okay because he'd heard that there'd been an accident. So that kind of just, you know, set the feelers up and I thought, oh, what's going on here? She's never late for work. And she was living at home at the time, so she left home, so I knew she had gone to work. So then, you know, I tried to call her and obviously I couldn't get through and it just kind of snowballed from there. To my partner was coming home and he knew the police in the area. He worked quite closely with the police in the area. So he contacted them and that's how we kind of found out.
Brooke's just like any of us or any of our kids. She's an active, caring, passionate individual who just loved life. She was the kind of person that you'd love to have as a next door neighbour. She shaved her head for cancer fundraising. She was always looking out for ways to help others, either through her hairdressing or just through her friendship, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was. She would do anything. She would give anyone her last dollar. She was, I suppose you could say, a true humanitarian. She would say to me only about 6 weeks before the accident, she said, "Mum, can I donate a kidney?" And I said, "No, you can't donate a kidney, Brooke." But she always felt like there was something for her in life that she needed to find. There was something she had to do for someone else. And I suppose that this is what's helping us is now I know what she was looking for and now I know that this was her thing to do in life.
And because of her care for others, she was actually texting a client telling them that she was going to be late, wasn't she?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, she, you know, and I suppose you get in the car and you start multitasking. Start thinking about what you're doing for the day and she was just thinking about ahead and thinking what she had to do. So, you know, we live in this society where everything, we get instant gratification for things, but we also get that connection with people straight away. And so that's what she was doing. She was just working in her mind through her day and doing it ahead of time.
Can I ask you about that moment? Was it 6 months before when you sat her down when you heard that she was texting in the car from one of her friends?
Yeah, so someone had said to me that they were worried that she was texting and driving, and so I sat her down and I said, you know, Brooke, this is really dangerous. And, you know, many years ago when the mobile phones started to come onto the scene, people pulled over all the time. You would see see people on the side of the road, but you don't see that anymore. And Brooke had a brand new car too. She had a Nissan Dualis that was only 6 months old and it had the Bluetooth option, but people don't contact or speak, young people don't speak virtually to each other anymore. It's all via text message.
Yeah.
So the Bluetooth is great, but if you are still using that text technology, it's not going to help you.
The heartbreaking irony here is that the phone survived the accident, didn't it?
That's exactly right. The phone was between her feet and it survived. It was actually open on the message, obviously.
Yeah.
So, you know, in a way, that's nice for us to have that because I still have our messages between each other, which I actually take when I speak to young children. I speak at schools quite often and I show them that, yes, you know, Brooke and I loved our phones, but you need to know how to use it safely.
How did Brooke's accident change your relationship with your friends through your phone?
It changed a lot. I now don't even touch my phone when I'm in the car before, and I'll be honest, and most people will do the same. They will pick up their phone and look at a text yeah. message. And, you know, I think I tried to text a message once while I was driving and worked out that I wasn't any good at it, and it really wasn't a need for me. But it's the younger generation that, like I say, that instant gratification they need, that's the issue. And, you know, so I just say to them, put it in the back, because you're only human. You know, if it's sitting next to me in the car, then I will pick it up. I don't, you know, I have that urge. I sit there and I go, oh, I want to know who that is. Yeah. So, and people just seem to think they're too busy to pull over and they can't give a minute or two out of their lives. And sometimes we think we are busier than what we really are. And yeah.
It's never just sending the message, though, is it? Then you're waiting for a response.
Exactly, exactly. And I am quite pleased that Brooke was the initiator in sending the message, because then we don't have anyone else feeling guilty about sending her a message.
Yeah.
So that was kind of one good thing that happened on the day.
You have channeled all of your energies now into meeting school kids, as you said, and also talking to the wider community about the Don't Text and Drive program. And aside from Don't Do It, what else are you sharing with people about the way that we are relating to each other through our mobile devices?
Yeah, I just think that, you know, like a lot of people, that's all they do now is they text, they don't speak to each other. You have the Bluetooth device in your car, if you do, so use that, you know. I'm still a bit wary about the Bluetooth, you know, that your concentration isn't fully on the road.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's better than, you know, it's a better option than picking the phone up. And, you know, when I speak to kids, you know, I try and say to them, you know, the phones are great. They're a great way of communicating. But, you know, if you're next to each other, hey, let's have a chat with each other rather than use the phone. My thing is, I suppose, we can't change how the way society is going, and so we just have to learn how to use it correctly. That's, you know, we're never going to be able to stop this. It's just a snowball effect that's just going to keep going. And so I just say to kids, you know, think about what you're doing and how you're doing it, mainly.
Vicky, thanks so much for your time. I can't imagine the courage that it must have taken to start this program. I know that it was part of your own personal recovery, but to talk so soon after your daughter died, and to create this campaign of DontTextAndDrive.com, as well as the Facebook page, is a testament to how much you care about other people's kids, and we're going to thank you for doing that for us.
Oh, no, thank you. I just don't want another family to have to go through what we've been through. And, yeah, we're just doing this for Brooke, and it's keeping her memory alive.